catastrophic levels in the besieged territory. Thank you for joining us. The leader of the Hezbollah resistance movement says the Israeli regime failed to achieve any of its goals in nearly 14 months of aggression on Lebanon.
We have the legendary martyrdom, steadfastness of the resistance fighters, which does not fear death. This steadfastness amazed the world, and it also frightened the Israeli military, and it caused its politicians and its people to lose hope. All of these factors, first and foremost, the battlefield, the enemy ended its aggression without achieving its goal. We did not want war from the start.
Sheikh Naim Qassem made the remark in his first address since the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon took effect on Wednesday. He called the ceasefire a major victory for Lebanon, greater than the triumph achieved back in 2006. He said the group's operations resulted in hundreds of losses amongst Israeli soldiers and the displacement of thousands of settlers from the northern occupied territories. The Hezbollah chief said the group's support for Gaza is a religious and humane duty which will never stop. Sheikh Naim Qassem, however, stressed Hezbollah is not seeking a war with the Israeli regime but is fully prepared in case of any new aggression on the Arab country. Caravans of Lebanese who were forcibly displaced during an Israeli aggression flocked to their homes. And despite the loss of houses and even loved ones, they say they are victorious since they were not broken. Mariam Saleh has this report.
Despite reports of Israeli violations of a ceasefire deal in Lebanon, the people of South Lebanon, the Bekaa and South Beirut eagerly drove back to their homes. Raising the picture of martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they returned to collect the pieces, but their resilience was evident in their words.
Our message to Netanyahu and the Israeli enemy is this. No matter what you do, you cannot break our will. And Sayyid Hassan is the crown of our nation, and his blood is more valuable and honorable than anything.
This is a gift from us to all resistance fighters in the Arab and Muslim worlds. We thank God for this victory. There were 70,000 Israeli soldiers at our border, but they could not enter by force, and they will never be able to unarm the resistance.
Hezbollah officials have already begun coordinating with the Lebanese government to begin a new phase of rebuilding.
We will rebuild our homes, and we will negotiate with our partners in Lebanon to rebuild the state politically and economically.
They failed in 2006 and failed in their so-called plot for a new Middle East. This is in itself a victory despite the suffering, the sorrow, the destruction and displacement. A victory is measured in strategic terms and not the destruction of a house or the loss of our beloved brothers whom we are saddened to miss.
Hezbollah believes the upcoming era will be the beginning of a wider alliance for the people of the region to form a strength that Israel cannot break.
As Hezbollah's resistance concluded what many experts are calling the most brutal battle in its history, the people of Lebanon have begun a new chapter of dusting themselves off and wiping out the traces of the Israeli killing machine. Mariam Saleh from the southern suburbs of Beirut.
Welcome back. Hamas has condemned as a brutal crime Israel's attacks on two residential buildings in northern Gaza that killed at least 75 people. Hamas said most of the victims of the attacks in Beit Lahia were women and children. The group said medical teams are unable to reach the affected area as Israel continues to bar them from entering the battered north. Israel has besieged the area for nearly 2 months now amid a vicious bombing campaign against civilian structures. On Friday, Israeli strikes also killed three in a separate attack in the north and leveled residential buildings in Rafah in the south. The Israeli genocide has killed over 44,360 Palestinians since October 2023. The onslaught has injured over 105,000 others. Hunger and suffering in the Gaza Strip has reached catastrophic levels. That's what Gaza government's media office is saying about the Palestinian territory under the Israeli siege and subject to the regime's ongoing genocidal campaign. The government has condemned what it called the utter failure of humanitarian agencies to assist Gazans. It says such organizations as the World Food Programme have refused to supply flour to families who line up at bakeries. The government says Israel has been using hunger as a tool against Gazans, especially women and children, since the regime began its onslaught 420 days ago. The statement comes after a child and two women lost their lives in a stampede outside a bakery in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza Strip. Our correspondent in Gaza, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier for more details about the latest Israeli strikes across the Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
Today was another bloody day for the Palestinian people in different parts of Gaza Strip, whereas several appalling massacres actually unfolded for the past 12 hours after the Israeli occupation forces intensified their air raids against different parts of Gaza Strip. First and foremost, let me begin with the northern part of Gaza Strip, whereas 75 Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children, were killed after the Israeli warplanes targeted several populated houses in Al-Manshiya area in Bitlahia City, which is still the focal point of those ongoing and unabated Israeli airstrikes and attacks. In addition to that, we are talking about dozens of the Palestinian people who are still believed missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. According to Gaza Civil Defense System, that at least 2,700 Palestinian civilians have been killed and slain since the onset of this genocidal campaign targeting the northern section of Gaza Strip for its 60th consecutive day. In addition to that, we are talking about 10,000 Palestinian civilians that were confirmed wounded as a result of those constant and non-stop Israeli strikes and attacks targeting those areas. It's worth mentioning that at least 60,000 Palestinian civilians are still believed stranded and besieged in the northern part of Gaza Strip. According to Gaza Civil Defense System, that those Palestinian people are starving these moments as the Israeli occupation forces are still stymieing any entry of the basic and the indispensable humanitarian needs they need in order to survive this catastrophic situation.
Welcome back. Resistance groups have conducted several anti-Israeli operations in the occupied West Bank to retaliate the regime's bloodshed in the Palestinian territory. Our correspondent Nika Hamad was earlier with us for the details.
We are talking about three operations that took place. The first one and the most intense was near Ariel settlement to the west. To the west of Nablus, where nine IOF soldiers were repeatedly injured. Three of them have very severe injuries, while a Palestinian man shot at a bus that was coming from Tel Aviv towards Ariel settlement today. It has taken place in Ariel settlement, which is considered to be one of the biggest settlements over here in the West Bank, and it has many outposts surrounding this area. So the second operation was a shooting that happened near Al Khalil today, and the performer, as the IOF announced, was able to escape from the scene. And until now, the IOF is searching in Al-Khalil area, which has led to closing to many roads and making incursions to many areas in Al-Khalil. The third one, and it is still an ongoing event, that a shooting has taken place near Hussein, which is near Bethlehem, which led the IOF to bring a large amount and large military vehicles and soldiers surrounding Hussein and besieging the town.
The Syrian army says it has inflicted heavy losses and casualties on foreign-backed terrorists on the outskirts of the northern or northwestern cities of Aleppo and Idlib. The Syrian army says it has killed and injured hundreds of terrorists. The army added that it had also destroyed dozens of armored vehicles and shot down 17 drones. He said Syrian forces had repelled a major offensive on Aleppo and regained control of areas that had been seized by the terrorists. The army stressed that it will continue to reinforce its ranks to foil the foreign-backed aggression. Earlier, terrorists launched artillery strikes against Aleppo, targeting a student housing. The attack left four civilians dead and several others wounded. Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy for more than a decade now. Earlier, our Syria correspondent Ibrahim Wadi shed light on the latest developments regarding the country's fight against terrorism. Let's take a listen.
They're currently trying to make their way to the eastern neighborhoods of the city. It seems that they lack both of the manpower and military equipment to establish a military zone or establish any military point for what matters. These terrorist groups are summoned or gathered from radical Turkish-backed terrorists, Islamic Turkestani Party, Mustafa Front, aka Hayat al-Sham, HTS, and other affiliated groups. They depended in their wide-scale attack on large numbers of terrorists using medium and heavy weapons, suicide bombers, and advanced drones, which they gained from Ukraine lately. Russian and Syrian warplanes have been targeting the terrorist headquarters and supply lines in Idlib and Aleppo western countryside, along with artillery and missile units. The army and its allied forces have inflicted heavy losses in both personnel and equipment on the terrorists. According to the Russian Coordination Center in Syria, over 600 terrorists were killed in the past couple of days. Only 200 today. 200 of them were killed only today.
Iran has once again reiterated its support for Syria as terrorist groups conduct new operations in the Arab country. Iran's foreign minister made the remarks during a phone call with his Syrian counterpart, Bassam Sabaq. Abbas Araghchi said the resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria is a U.S.-Israeli plan following the Tel Aviv regime's defeat in Lebanon and Palestine. He said Tehran will continue supporting the Syrian government, nation and army to fight terrorism and protect regional security and stability. For his part, Sabah said the Syrian government and people are standing against the terrorist groups with all their strength. The top diplomat said they will fail to achieve their evil intentions. Journalist and podcaster Isha Krishnaswamy says the timing of terrorist resurgence in Syria just after Lebanon's ceasefire is suspicious.
This has been connected to the ceasefire in Lebanon, and we have known for years that Israel has been providing support to what the West calls are the rebels, who are actually complete terrorists, who belong to groups like Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. And Israel has been providing medical aid for them and also providing logistical support. So it seems the timing seems very curious for there not to be some kind of joint U.S.-Israeli involvement, because for the past few years, the Syrian army have pushed the terrorist groups to the northern corner of the country. And for them to come back is with such speed is very curious, and hopefully within the next couple of days we'll figure out who is really behind their resurgence and renewed attacks against Aleppo and other areas. It can also be seen as a provocation against Russia because of how close the ties between Russia and the Syrian government has been, both militarily and economically. And so I think this is kind of trying to ignite maybe a cold war on the second front here in Syria, in addition to Ukraine.
On the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, a massive demonstration has been held in Jordan's capital Amman near the U.S. embassy to condemn American support for Israel. The protesters have also expressed solidarity with the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights amidst the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Zaida Karba has this report.
A massive popular march took place near the U.S. Embassy in Amman. to condemn American support for Israel amidst the systematic aggression, genocide, and displacement policies carried out by the regime against the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank.
This march by the Jordanian people near the American embassy reaffirms our unwavering support for the people of Gaza and our commitment to the cause of Palestine. I want to emphasize that the Jordanian people have always stood firmly behind the cause of Palestine. The Al-Aqsa flood has demonstrated that resistance is the only path to national liberation.
Participants in the protest march called for immediate international intervention in Gaza, urging the Security Council to compel Israel to stop its crimes. They also called on the Arab League to rally global support to oppose Israel's aggressive measures. Protesters described Washington as the root cause of the problems in the West Asia region.
Today, the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance are sending a clear message to the world. It is time to distance yourselves from America. America is the chief perpetrator, the primary and ultimate criminal, actively contributing to the genocide and the ongoing tragedy in Gaza.
We send a clear message to the Palestinian people, to the Palestinian resistance, and to the world. The Jordanian political front stands united in support of the resistance, in solidarity with the Palestinian people, and most importantly, in confronting the malicious Zionist project. Our message today is not only to call for an end to the war and the ongoing genocide, nor simply to advocate for humanitarian aid, but to unite under one banner in resistance to the Zionist agenda.
The protesters urgently demanded an immediate end to all forms of genocide and war crimes committed by Israel against Gazans for over a year. These actions have escalated the humanitarian crisis in Gaza into a catastrophic state, with healthcare systems collapsing and living conditions deteriorating to an unprecedented level never witnessed before.
Protesters in Jordan expressed unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and a strong opposition to its policies that facilitate and empower Israeli acts of genocide in Gaza. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
And that's it for this hour's bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
An unnamed Israeli source quoted by Khan reportedly said that Benjamin Netanyahu refused to accept a deal to satisfy Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who had threatened to leave the government if the deal was signed. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the Zionist regime prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, lost an opportunity to reach a prisoner swap deal with Hamas in July to appease his far-right coalition partners, National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, Khan, has reported. According to the report cited by the Anadolu news agency, Hamas was willing to release several Israeli hostages without demanding a full ceasefire in return. The report suggested that Hamas' willingness at the time was an attempt to link the first and second phases of a U.S. ceasefire proposal, which included humanitarian aid. The report did not provide further details. However, although Hamas has repeatedly said that it would only release the Israeli captives if the deal resulted in a complete cessation of Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza. At the time, the U.S. proposal included three phases. The first involved an immediate ceasefire, the release of women, the elderly, and the wounded Israeli captives, and a prisoner exchange, as well as the withdrawal of Israeli forces from populated areas of Gaza. It also included increasing humanitarian aid, rebuilding basic services, and facilitating the return of civilians to their homes across Gaza. The second phase required the release of all remaining hostages and the complete withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from Gaza, aiming to end the crisis definitely. The third phase involved the reconstruction of Gaza over several years and the return of Israeli troops remains. Khan said that Netanyahu rejected the proposal, particularly opposing the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, with areas like the Philadelphia Corridor and Netzarim Axis becoming obstacles to the ceasefire process, according to Anadolu. An unnamed Israeli source quoted by the broadcaster said that Netanyahu's refusal to accept the deal was to satisfy Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, who had threatened to leave the government if the deal was signed. Mediation efforts led by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have so far failed to achieve a Gaza ceasefire and prisoner swap deal. Recently, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for child killer Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zohri said recently that the Palestinian resistance movement's utmost priority is halting and ending the aggression on Gaza. In a statement, Abu Zohri reiterated its position of not settling for understandings that do not alleviate the suffering of our people, guarantee their return to their homes, and ensure full reconstruction of all life facilities. He also highlighted the plight of the Palestinian people in Gaza, slamming the West and particularly the United States regime for continuing to support Israel in its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. The Hamas leader said this brutal campaign would not have persisted without Western, particularly American, support in the form of financial and military aid, as well as political and media backing, adding that such support justifies and covers up the occupation's crimes and obstructs any role by the UN Security Council to stop this genocide. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the Zionist regime has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on Gaza. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the Israeli regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 45,000 Palestinians have, to date, been martyred, and at least 4,567 wounded. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead, under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime war has also resulted in an acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt, in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from the south to the central Gaza in a constant search for safety.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, patience, also called sabr. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab. So today I'm talking to you a little bit about patience, which is a, let's say, one of the biggest positive traits we need to develop. And I'm just going to say one thing, though, but when you start to read or hear, understand more about patience, you're also going to find out that it's actually far from the highest station. And inshallah, I'll be able to explain a little bit about that to you. So, patience, for example, just to give you some of the background, patience relates to, for example, is said to be an outcome of freeing ourselves from lust, from being attached to our worldly desires. Now, for example, one of our famous scholars in the past, Nasser al-Din al-Tusi, said that patience means to restrain the self from agitation when confronted with undesirables. Or patience has also been said to restrain the self from complaint about hidden anguish. Okay, so obviously we have So I will go straight into this idea that patience is not the highest station, because usually we're talking about patience and how we need to develop patience, and I'll get onto that. But let's do this. Let's have a look at why patience is not the highest station. Because obviously, if we're patient, imagine to yourself you're going through something really difficult. Let's say, and this occurs in some cases where maybe families are separated. Imagine, for example, someone has emigrated to a country, but they have to sort out their paperwork in that country. And obviously, they're separated from their family. The family is supposed to come, like the wife and children. But maybe, I've heard of a case which was really painful to hear about, where the husband is in the other country and wife and children, takes 4 years for wife and children to join. So let's just talk about a case like that, where we're really trying to flex this muscle called patience. And I'll call it a muscle called patience, like an inner muscle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RIB English Radio. So I'm talking to you about what patience is. And I said I'm going to look at why patience isn't a high station. And I'm talking about this case, which is not an extreme case. If this is a real life case, where your family, a family is separated for 4 years. And now, obviously, you can imagine this causes anguish in a person. And obviously, so it might also lead to the family, the different family members, maybe even complaining, talking to their other friends, to other family members. Oh, look, this is so difficult. What am I to do? How much longer is this going to go on? So, and this might go on for 4 years. So it might be. And you can imagine, So the reason why we say, so this being able to endure these 4 years patiently in itself is, of course, a very good level to be a very good station. But if you want to understand why it's not the highest station, so think to yourself, if we feel anguish, if we are complaining in any way, even if we're just complaining to Allah and asking Allah to help us, in a sense, we haven't quite gained that sort of inner acceptance. We haven't quite reminded ourselves that, oh, whatever Allah does is okay. Allah knows the end. Allah knows the outcome. Allah controls the outcome. So, you know, it's going to be okay. So we actually don't need to complain and feel anguish. So this is a particular kind of inner peace that obviously we're supposed to get there. This is the idea. Islam is training us to get this. And this is why patience is like this stage we pass through. And, you know, maybe it's not many of us who are able to get through and get to that higher station where we are almost beyond patience. We don't feel the anguish. We don't complain. We just have that peace. But inshallah, this maybe just gives you some ideas that where we could be headed. So let's work on the patience first, and then let's see if we can really get that inner peace. So inshallah, you've gained something different from this episode, and inshallah, you tune in to another episode of A to Z and RB English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The story of death, destruction, stress and trauma is the everyday story of the Palestinian people who are being suffered by the Zionist thugs for 76 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the first missile the Israeli occupation forces fired at the Abu Nasr family home in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, on October 28, hit the stairwell. Around 300 members of the extended Abu Nasr family had taken shelter in the 10 apartments of the five-story building, and the stairwell was the only escape route. After the first missile was fired at 10 p.m. that night, the majority of people in the building could not escape.
When the second missile was fired at 4 a.m. the next morning, only 15 members of the extended family survived, 10 children and 5 men. Hani Abu Nasr is 39 years old. His wife and sons were killed in the Zionist regime attacks. He said the occupation forces fired a reconnaissance missile at the building's staircase on October 28 at 10 p.m., blocking a critical escape route. Unaware that further strikes would follow, only my brother, who lived on the ground floor and did not need to use the stairs, managed to escape with his wife and children. The remaining family members and I were trapped and unable to evacuate, so we called civil defense and ambulance services only to be told that no assistance could reach us at that time. We gathered our belongings, hoping to seek help at dawn. Tragically, the occupation forces struck again, shattering that hope. He said, the occupation aircraft attacked a building with missiles from an F-16 on October 29th at 4 a.m., reducing the house to a pile of rubble. When the airstrike happened, I didn't hear or feel anything. I woke up and found myself on the roof of a building next to ours. It was morning and I could hear people screaming and the sound of neighbors pulling victims from our house and the nearby houses that had also been damaged by the airstrike, including the Ode family's home. My arm was bleeding and the pain was excruciating. My ribcage hit and I felt as though it was fractured. I couldn't speak or scream, and there was no one around to see me or help. Looking around, I saw stones scattered across the surface where I lay. I tried to crawl on my back to the edge of the roof and began throwing stones to get someone's attention. After the third attempt, I finally heard someone say, "There is someone here." Muhammad Abu Nasr, 29, is Hani Abu Nasr's brother, mentioned above by Hani as the family member who escaped with his wife and children after the first Zionist regime strike. He said, when the explosion happened and the outer wall of the building collapsed into my home, I knew we were in danger and had to get out. I jumped over the wall and saw that the building's staircase had been destroyed, leaving no way for my family to escape without the help of civil defense or ambulance crews. I didn't know whether to save myself and my family or stay and face the death with the rest of them. Muhammad jumped over the wall and his wife had to throw their children over the wall to him. They fled to a neighbor's house, unable to travel long distances at night with quadcopters patrolling the skies. He said, I didn't sleep that whole night, thinking about my parents, my brothers, my nieces and nephews. How could I leave them and run away? Was I really a coward, a traitor? Thoughts tormented me and I couldn't tell whether I had done the right thing or not. Eventually, I fell asleep, but only for 10 minutes. I woke to the sound of an explosion louder than anything I had ever heard. It felt like an earthquake had shaken an entire area, with the ground trembling violently and parts of the walls in the house I'd taken refuge in collapsing. I realized then that the sound came from the targeting of my family's house. I could hear my family's voices screaming and pleading for help. They were saying there were many wounded and there were martyrs. The pain was unbearable, made worse by the fact that I couldn't go out. Everyone told me not to, warning that I'd be putting myself in danger. I had to wait until morning because the Israeli Air Force was patrolling the skies. I sat there, listening to my family's cries, powerless to help. Muhammad recovered 117 bodies from the rubble and said that he believed an additional 130 were still buried under the rubble. Aida Abu Nasr, 15, survived, yet all of her immediate family was martyred. She said, We lived on the fifth floor, and when the reconnaissance missile struck on October 28, my mother, my sister, and I were injured. We had been sleeping next to each other in the living room. The rest of my family was unharmed, but they couldn't do anything to help us because no one could get out. Our injuries weren't severe at first, but we were bleeding, and I had terrible pain in my legs. They shouted and called for help, but no one responded. Those who were uninjured began preparing bags and gathering essential items, hoping to leave in the morning. When the missiles from the F-16 hit at 4 a.m., I didn't hear anything, but I never lost consciousness. At first, a thick black cloud blocked my vision, but gradually everything cleared. I found myself between my mother and my sister. The section we were on was tilted and about to collapse. I survived because I was on the top floor, but those injured on the lower floors continued to bleed out, unable to be rescued. My mother was clinging to my right arm, and my sister Rania was holding on to my left arm, afraid of falling. They were both injured, and I kept asking, "Are you okay?" They could only gesture with their eyes. They couldn't speak. My leg was trapped under a block of concrete, and I was screaming and begging for help while my other foot was trapped under the rubble. Whenever I tried to free it, my mother held on to me even tighter, terrified of falling. She said, "I stayed still, holding my position to reassure them. Then I suddenly felt her hand slip from my arm. I turned to look and saw that she had died. And my pregnant sister on the other side had passed away before her without me even noticing. I kept trying to free my foot until after several attempts, I finally succeeded. By then, morning had come, and I was limping because of my injured foot, walking over the remains of my brothers, mother, and father, shouting, 'Help me, help me.' Ida was taken to Al-Auda Hospital on a cart. Rescue teams tried to recover what they could of her family, but they only retrieved her mother and sister. Ida was eventually transferred from Al-Auda Hospital to Al-Helu Hospital.
International Media Festival.
Part 2.
Today I'll be talking to a journalist who, through his fact-finding mission, has become an expert on Islamic jihadi groups. One of his quotes is this: "During my relentless pursuit of the truth, I've discovered that it has many faces, and each one of us will only believe his own definition of what truth is." This is SOAP, and I'm your host, Hassan Tavakoli.
Radwan Murtada was born in Libya in 1984 and moved to Lebanon in 1993. In 2007, he started his professional career as a journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper. Since then, he's worked as a journalist, documentary filmmaker, researcher, writer, executive producer, and assignment producer. In 2014, he founded Blue House Film, a production company based in Beirut, Lebanon.
Radwan Murtaza, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Speaking about documentaries, 42 documentaries, how do you find the time to make these? You know, how old are you to begin with?
40.
40. I mean, 42 documentaries. You know, if you want to divide them into, you know, calculate some things, that would be, you know, when did you start making documentaries? When was the very first time you started making documentaries? What age?
I have begun making films since 2008, but I founded a production company in 2013. At the beginning, given that I was in contact with jihadists, wanted people, and drug dealers, I was a field producer for most of foreign journalists who arrived in Lebanon. I worked on myself and learned. I made two films in Syria where I was the cameraman, the director, and the journalist at the same time, as I didn't want to endanger someone's life, and decided to risk my life alone and didn't accompany anyone. I made two films, one of them named Yabrud Battle and the other one on Qalamun Mountains, where I filmed the extremist groups that were striking Lebanon and sending car bombs to Lebanon. Subsequently, some documentaries can take several years. I'm currently working on one of that nature because it covers different aspects. Other documentaries can be made in 2 or 3 months. When films take more time, it's usually due to the need to obtain permits for interviews or because of the lengthy process of obtaining necessary documents. Making documentaries is like writing articles. Practicing makes them easier. It might take several days to write an article, but with practice, you can write an article in 2 hours. Given my experience in making documentaries, I know how long each phrase of it takes, including editing. Even when I conduct an interview, I know what I want, so I rarely get surprised by the answers of the interviewee. I usually know the answers that they will say and know which part of it I'll use in my film. The process of making a documentary or a movie is enjoyable. It's a creation of something that didn't exist. It allows you to present your views. Films are like historical documents. They are familiar to books. This is how the Syrian Revolution grew its beard, was my first book. But the number of readers is less than the number of viewers, as people prefer the easiest thing. I love making documentaries as they combine writing and filming. There is a better thing, which is drama, as you reach a wider audience. All the journalists, the directors, and producers wanted to reach the largest possible number of people.
Yes, that's the very important point that many people and many journalists say, and many artists, in fact, say that, you know, it's the art of communication, communicating with people and sending them their, sending messages and telling different stories.
Exactly.
Most of your work, your documentary work, is literally all of it is basically political. Have you ever, found interest in, entering the field of non-political documentaries or cinematic stuff?
Political documentaries are my passion as they deliver a message. The problem of those films is that they are good just for a specific time and they can only be watched later by those who are searching the archive. Unlike cultural and social documentaries, such as those on music that I previously mentioned, they can be good for any time and place. Some films like drama persist and can be watched at any time. Hollywood is spending billions of dollars on making movies because they promote their lifestyle and deliver specific messages and try to show that the U.S. can control the planet. Even when Israelis decided to begin producing, they made a number of series, including Tehran. When someone watches it, they will wonder who produced it and how it became famous, given that it's a mess. Cinema and media is a weapon. There are not too many people interested in politics. For example, the new generation is not interested in politics, so you have to make them familiar with it using alternative methods. Apart from newspapers, news bulletins, and political talk shows, you can use social media platforms and short videos that are affordable to form their mindset. Movies and series are also helpful as the new generation can be influenced by their protagonists. Consequently, you can direct him to what you believe is the right path.
What would your advice be to aspiring filmmakers and journalists who want to, follow in your footsteps, make documentaries and, get into the work you do? What would your advice be to them?
I'm not sure if I'm in a position to give advice, but I think the most important thing is insistence. Working in this field is tiring as it affects your personal life. your entire life revolves around work, which consumes a significant amount of time. Searching for new ideas and trying to reveal truth require time. As I enjoy my work, time passes without me noticing. If you're not passionate about this job and if you lack resoluteness, you won't be able to persist in doing it. And if you manage to persist in doing it without passion, you'll be an employee doing your routine job. I didn't want to be an employee and to abide by specific working hours. So I established my own company to take control of my time. But actually, it's my job that's taking control of my time. So you have to do this job with passion and determination and view it as a hobby that makes money and not as a job. Because if you considered that as a job, you wouldn't succeed.
Yes, the life of a journalist and a filmmaker together is very difficult, as you said. One has not doesn't have a life.
Crazy, you know? People, and
yeah. But so how do you balance that? You know, work and your personal life. How do you balance it?
I just got married about a year ago, and my first child was born just 40 days ago. So work has affected my personal life. I try to create a balance between them, but I have failed to do so. Still, I hope to make that balance, which is so hard. People who succeed in both of their personal life and professional life deserve applause. I hope I'll make that someday.
And so how will that new life that you've, you know, brought into your own life, okay, a wife, a child, how would that affect your future cinematography?
Now I've become more selective. In the past, I worked on various topics, but now the works that I choose to make should be iconic because I dedicate my time to them at the expense of my daughter, wife, and family. So these works should have a message and benefit the people. After all, none of us will last forever, so I hope my work will speak for me.
Would you like your daughter to follow in your footsteps? To be a journalist or a film director or something?
I would like my daughter to become a film director because of the risks associated with being a journalist. I've faced many threats, and there have been repeated attempts to hack my cell phone by various parties, even by governments. I was the first one in Lebanon to be targeted by a company cooperating with Israel that hacks the journalists' cell phones. I was based in the UAE. Journalists are always threatened by whoever you write an article about them. Consequently, journalists have to be careful when they are moving. I'm calm and know how to handle those issues and also have an experience. But I think this profession can be so dangerous and stressful for a girl. Therefore, I won't encourage my daughter to become a journalist, but I will encourage her to become a film director.
At the end of every show of ours, we request our guest to look into the camera opposite them and speak their mind, you know, to whomever they want to address, you know, to the world, to whoever they have in mind. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, in this episode, we spoke a lot about me, but amidst our conversation, I emphasized that resistance fighters are being martyred for the sake of a just cause that they embrace. They are defending me and my family in Lebanon. At the same time, our people in Palestine are brutally killed amid the silence of the world. This scene highlights that we are at a crossroad that shows who supports the truth and who supports the oppressor. Since October 7, a new chapter of history has been written. We shouldn't forget that. We also should keep praying for the resistance fighters. Moreover, we have to continue to wield our words, weapons, and every possible means to build a better future for us and for our region, to be able to liberate our countries and be independent from global arrogance, and to build countries full of justice, safety, and stability. This speech may be dismissed by some people as mere slogans after they had been repeated by officials, but those words should be transformed into tangible actions. We can build a better society.
And we thank our guest Radwan Murtada from Lebanon for taking part in this program. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team here, it's goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from iranradio.ir Well, in this program what we do is to talk about some of the viewpoints and sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and then try to shed light and talk about some of the points in these statements. Well, about condemning conceit and self-love, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, a person afflicted with ujb never cares to rectify himself. Rather, he considers himself as a pious and virtuous person and never thinks of purging himself from sins. The curtain of ujb and the thick veil of conceit prevents him from seeing his shortcomings. Well, this viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is about a miserable consequence of ujb, which is neglecting one's own shortcomings. Conceit causes selfishness and vanity, which are the causes of people's dissatisfaction and humiliation. It turns one's eyes away from noticing his own defects. The conceited forgets his sins and causes himself many damages, since negligence of the sins stops against repentance to God and exposes his wrath. You know, humility comes from knowing about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his names and attributes and his greatness, venerating him, loving him, and being in awe of him. And also from knowing about oneself and one's faults and weakness. From that may develop the attitude of humility, which means feeling helpless before God and being humble and compassionate towards his slaves, so that the person does not feel superior towards anyone or think that he has any right over anyone else. Rather, he thinks that others are better than him and that their rights come before his. This is a characteristic that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives to those whom He loves, honors, and draws close attention to them.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
Sallallahu alayhi
Salli ala
In fact, humbleness raises one's status with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, charity does not diminish wealth. Allah does not increase a man in anything for his pardoning others but in honor. And none humbles himself for Allah, but Allah raises him. This narration is representative of the satisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala when his servant sees his own shortcomings before others. And Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, just in line with this narration, warned us about conceit and the malicious consequences of it on the soul of an individual. Okay, well, dear listeners, we have no more time to continue this episode. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about condemning conceit and self-love. He says, a person afflicted with ujb never cares to rectify himself. Rather, he considers himself as a pious and virtuous person and never thinks